Welcome to episode 112 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is October 12th, 2020, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Today's guest is Stephanie Kane. Stephanie is a lawyer and an award-winning author of 6 crime novels. Born in Brooklyn, New York, and raised in New Haven, Connecticut, she came to Colorado as a freshman at Colorado University. She owned and ran a karate studio in Boulder and is a second-degree black belt. After graduating from law school, she was a corporate partner at a top Denver law firm before becoming a criminal defense attorney. She has lectured on money laundering and white-collar crime in Eastern Europe and has given workshops throughout the country on writing technique. She lives in Denver with her husband and her 2 black cats. Most interestingly about this interview is that Stephanie tells me a story about her first novel, which was a fictional account of a real event, only to have that fictional account become the catalyst for reopening the cold case from which the real event was based. This is a good story. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning 5 decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. On alternating weeks, we are introducing a new podcast, How to Rocket Your PI Business, featuring successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice for those just starting out or for those who are struggling. We will learn from the best. And of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share a few of their favorite detective stories and sage marketing tips. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring you inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in. This episode is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat and mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marsha O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but now is drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. You can buy Odessa from your favorite online retailer.
Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, how's life out there in the greater Denver area today?
Well, we're not quite under quarantine, but, you know, it's probably about like what it is in Milford, Connecticut.
That's right. And you have been a visitor to my fine town in the past. That's right, right?
Yeah, well, actually, my parents are from New Haven, so we had a little cottage on the shore in Milford in Point Beach that we went to every summer when I was growing up. So
wow, that's fantastic.
I know the area and love it.
Yeah, and it wasn't a far commute from home either. I mean, it was,
right,
2 towns away.
Yep.
Yeah, I love my beaches here in Connecticut. I spend a lot of time there. I actually am dictating my most recent novel from the jetty at Gulf Beach overlooking Milford Harbor.
Oh, fantastic.
With Charles Island in the distance. And
But I'm Welch's
doing
Point?
Yeah, I'm doing a crime thriller, so it doesn't have to do with pirates or sunken treasure or anything like that. So, there's no nautical theme to it at all. So anyway.
Well, do you have the duck pond in it?
No. And I have not written my hometown in any of my books. Maybe the next one will be in the bucolic town of Milford, Connecticut. At least I like to think of it as bucolic. So anyway, but you're now out in Denver. So tell me about how your life got going and where, how it got to be that you got to be a writer, and just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, probably like most writers, I was a big reader as a kid. My parents, you know, all we ever got for Christmas was books and wristwatches. So I kind of come by it honestly. But I landed in Denver because when I was 18, I had this burning urge to go 2,000 miles from home, which I did to college. CU was the only college I applied to, and I knew nothing about it. So
really?
Yep. It was just, wow. You know, 2,000 miles. I could have thrown a dart and a map. But anyway, I ended up here, and when I graduated from college, I went to law school, and I practiced law for quite a number of years, the last few of which were criminal defense work, which was definitely the most fun. Mm-hmm. And then kind of my exit strategy from law was writing mysteries.
Wow. So had you written at all during your time as an attorney? Or?
Well, I was, you're not going to believe this, but I was basically a corporate lawyer.
Okay.
So I did tons of, you know, research and, you know, contracts, transactional stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, then I switched to criminal defense law and mm-hmm. I was in court. You know, I did some trials and wrote briefs, which was much more fun than contracts. And after a few years of that, I left and I started writing for real.
Okay. Now, we'll get into that in a second, but I just wanted to say I understand about throwing a dart on the map because when I talked to my parents about going to college, and I was the firstborn, and I think I was also the first to be possibly in our family to go to college, they asked me where I wanted to go. And back then, we had maps, you know, maps of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I was living in the suburbs of Philadelphia at the time. And I took a coffee saucer, and I drew a big circle around Philadelphia, and I said, anywhere outside of here. And because I did not want to be going home. I did not want them to come visit. I wanted to be on my own, and it sounded like that's what you wanted to do, too.
Yes, I think it's a very healthy impulse.
Yes.
I have never regretted it.
Oh, me neither. I attended a state university in western Pennsylvania called Indiana University of Pennsylvania. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
No, that's an interesting name, though.
Yes, it is. Everybody thought that I went to Indiana University, and I said, no, I went to Indiana University of Pennsylvania. And it is in the lovely county of Indiana County, and it is in the state of Indiana, Pennsylvania. So there, or in the city of Indiana, Pennsylvania. So it is you know, a nice little town. That's where I went for my criminology degree. But you went to Boulder, and you went on to get your law degree and then started writing. So, and I was going to say also that, you know, when I graduated from college, I became a police officer. But in my years as an investigator, I investigated insurance fraud and I did forensic genealogy, but it wasn't until most recently, like 2005, that I went back to doing work in the criminal area, criminal defense work, and I absolutely loved it. So I guess like you, you know, we both had the money-paying jobs, you know, the things that paid us to do what we did well, but we could be actually passionate about our work towards the latter part of our career. And as I sit here today talking with you, I still have one criminal exoneration case on my desk that I'm still working, and as I'm still a licensed PI, but my life has really become that of a writer as well, and I'm just finishing this case for the person because, well, they asked me to continue working on it. I've worked on it for over 5 years, and I'm going to finish it off. But anyway, what got you interested in writing mystery, and how did you take those initial steps? How did that happen?
Well, actually, the very first book that I wrote, first of all, I can't write a story unless there's an idea behind it that I want to explore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might call it self-therapy, but, you know, there has to be something, some itch that I have to scratch, something that I'm interested in exploring that I can really only do by inventing characters and setting them into a story. But the very first one that I wrote was sort of, it was a fictionalized version of a crime that I was involved in. It was called Quiet Time. You might call it the original crime. It's my only standalone mystery. And it was inspired by the 1973 murder of my mother-in-law-to-be. I was about to marry her son.
Oh, boy.
And it was really my introduction. I was 18 at the time. It was my introduction to adulthood and, you know, the real world of criminals and cops. You might call it I was a college freshman. So you might call it a college student's intro to reality 101. But anyway,
sure.
I, at the time, back in 73, my father-in-law was indicted for the murder. The charges were inexplicably dropped. So then I went on to, I was married to their son for about 10 years, and I went on to law school and, you know, became a lawyer and stuff. And when I decided I wanted to write, I really wanted to write that story, fictionalized, of course. And I had really no idea why the charges had been dropped or anything. It was published, it was the first book I published. It was published by Bantam in 2001. It came out like the week of 9/11, so it had a very short life and a quick death of its own. But it had an interesting second act. In 2005, I got a call from a cold case investigator asking me about the murder. And the book itself, a witness had seen me talking on TV about it and had recognized me from 30 years earlier, a member of that family, and she came forward with information about a confession, and they reindicted my then, he must have been in his 80s, father-in-law, and prosecuted him for murdering his wife. So that was actually the first book that I wrote, and I had no, you know, thought in the world that it could be anything but, you know, an entertaining mystery for somebody who read it, you know? And it had this impact, unlike anything else I've ever written, thank God.
Yeah, but if I understand this right, it's a fiction, and it's only in talking about the book that somebody heard about that, and then they... What, got in touch with you or got in touch with the police? And
They got in touch with the police because there were things in the book. I mean, it was fictionalized.
Okay.
But part of what I had done in my attempt to understand what happened was I accessed the, you know, the court file.
Okay.
And there was the transcript of the investigating officer, the lead officer in 1973. And the defense had attached it to a motion, and it wasn't sealed.
Wow.
So, you know, for the first time in like, you know, it was a gold mine for me because I could see, you know, I learned facts that I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know what the case was against my father-in-law. I had my own suspicions from being there that day, et cetera. And some of that I built into the plot. Bantam made me heavily fictionalize it. I mean, I was very honest with them about it. They made me change, like, Denver to Whittier or something like that, and Boulder to Stanley, and I couldn't mention the name of the state, and we moved the timeline up 10 years. I mean, we did, and I published it under my second husband's name, which I use as a pen name, but I adopted it as a pen name for this express purpose of not having the book be identified with a real case. And despite all of that, you know, I think the thing with cold cases is that they affect people.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, they never really die until they're resolved.
That's
so
right.
So when this relative, who was the sister, the elderly sister of my father-in-law, saw me interviewed about a book that most other people would have, you know, they would associate it with nothing. She made the associations. And that drove her to come forward to the police with information about a confession he had made. So I became a witness. And in fact, the defense subpoenaed all 20 drafts of Quiet Time and tried to use them to impeach my testimony. You know, they had some theory that I had somehow colluded with the elderly aunt who I hadn't seen in 30 years in order to sell books, you know. So that became, you know, I had to hire a lawyer who defended my right to write a work of fiction, basically.
Yep.
And, you know.
Yeah. And you got a prop on this from Ricky Kleinman from Court TV.
Stephanie and she had no idea that it was a real story.
Yeah. Stephanie Kane does it again. Quiet Time keeps your mind thinking and your heart racing. What a great read. Little did you know, little did Ricky Kleinman know that it would spur the sister of your ex-father-in-law to come forward with information. And I guess there was enough information for them to have probable cause to effect his arrest. And then you said there was a trial and he was...
They reindicted him and yeah. The defense ran the clock for a year and a half on pretrial motions, hoping that elderly witnesses would die. Some of them did. It went up and down the Colorado Court of Appeals, Colorado Supreme Court, back to the Court of Appeals on the admissibility of a confession.
Okay.
So, you know, four or five years were burned on that. And then it came back to the trial judge, and actually the prosecutor had dismissed the case pending the appeals. So it went through some procedural stuff, and, you know, at the end of the day, they didn't re-prosecute it.
Okay.
A new DA came onto the case and dumped it. This, okay. I'm sure, is not news to you. I mean, it happens all
no.
the time.
No.
But the defendant ended up killing himself on almost exactly the 40th anniversary of his wife's murder.
Now, was this after the prosecutor dropped the charges?
Yep.
Wow. So he was, I don't want to say scot-free, but he was...
Well, I like to think of it as a different kind of justice, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes when the legal system fails us, there are other forces, you know? I mean, you can call me a crazy idealist, but I really do believe the truth comes out. The truth is important, first of all, and that it comes out. And the world has a way of working in certain ways. You know, things get put back into balance, whether it's through, you know, the judicial system or not. So anyway, that was my first book. And then I went on and wrote a series of legal thrillers starring a dyslexic criminal defense lawyer who was a better lawyer because of her difficulties reading. And I published three legal thrillers. And then the cold case came about, and I just sort of went into a weird limbo for about 8 or 10 years and didn't write at all.
Really?
Yeah, and then when it well, for one thing, I was afraid to, because the defense was subpoenaing everything that I had, notes, everything. And being a lawyer, or just maybe a compulsive person, of course I saved everything. And I wasn't about to destroy it or pretend that I didn't have it, you know?
Right.
Which is why I had to have a lawyer defend my right to privacy with it, basically.
Yeah.
You know, all the drafts and stuff. The defense never got them. The court ruled that they were inadmissible because Quiet Time was a work of fiction. So they were not prior inconsistent statements of fact, the draft.
Wow. And that, therefore, it made them not material nor relevant to the trial at hand.
Exactly.
Wow.
So then, after my former father-in-law killed himself, and I had some personal resolution around that, I picked up with a new series. You know, I didn't want to go back to the lawyer stuff because, frankly, the whole experience had left me, you know, for the first time in my life with a really bad taste about the court system.
Mm-hmm.
I should tell you, I'm married to a judge, so we had a lot
okay.
of... You know, it just made me not want to go back to writing about a lawyer, dyslexic or not, you know, much less a criminal defense lawyer. But I still love mysteries and crime, so I invented a new heroine and placed her in the art world. She's a conservator of paintings at the Denver Art Museum. So that's how I came to all of that.
But I have to ask you, just this, the story you just told me has all the makings of a fantastic TV show, you know, like a true crime show. Honestly, I mean, has anybody ever approached you, or has anybody ever talked about doing a treatment on this, about how, you know, you wrote a fiction account, and somehow that fiction account resonated with your ex-father-in-law's sister, and then she then told the police about the confession, and then the following trial, all the motions and everything went on, and then on the 40th anniversary of the murder, right? I was going to say your ex-mother-in-law's death, but yeah, you're right, the murder. He kills himself. That just has, it just has made for TV, been written all over it for me. I don't know.
Write it as, when I finally got all the facts, I went out after my hands were untied. Because, you know, when you're a witness, you can't go and talk to other witnesses. You just can't.
Right. Right.
So after it was all over, I went and interviewed everybody who was still alive. I got the entire court file from 1973 and the cold case. I flew to Arizona and interviewed the original cop, who I had fictionalized in quiet time, but he was a real human being, and he had incredible memories of the case.
Okay.
I mean, I marshaled everything, and I tried to write it as nonfiction. And I got an agent, and he wasn't able to sell it. And you know, the feedback basically was, you know, who cares about a suburban housewife beaten to death in her garage? You know? So I sort of, you know, licked my wounds. And then what I did was I turned it into a blog called Cold Case Story Blog. And it's on my website. All of the posts are up. And I sort of interwove, but in a coherent fashion, the cold case with the murder, the original crime. I pieced it together, and I examined it through a storytelling lens, which you will, as a writer yourself, you will probably appreciate. You know, each post takes the what kicks off each post is a narrative technique, like point of view, or character arc, or inciting incidents, text and subtext, all of that. And so I told the story, I think, in the truest, the way that was truest to me, which was drawing on all these other resources and these interviews and everything, and then slicing them into intense posts that got the whole story out. And it's up on my website. It's called Cold Case Story Blog, and the story is told. So.
And how did you title it, or Cold Case Story Blog?
Yeah, because I look at it through the cold case through a storytelling lens, and that was very, very satisfying for me, because I stopped worrying about whether it could be published. I stopped, you know, I just sort of removed the internal censor. And then it was really rewarding, because I'm very interested in craft, narrative craft. So it was a chance for me to explore, to like highlight narrative craft as I was working through the facts of the case and the cold case and the witnesses and all of that. So it was a very fulfilling experience for me.
Yeah. I do. This is true life, and so we're not talking about fiction. We're talking about real things. So, if this is too personal of a question, then just tell me it's off limits, and we won't pursue it. But beware. Not beware. I'm not saying beware. What I'm saying is, it's your choice if you want to answer it or not. But you divorced your first husband.
Yep.
And did you have any contact with him during the time that the second trial, or the trial, was taking place, and until the time of his father's suicide?
Well, the reason I'll give you a very personal answer to this.
Okay.
I always felt, back in 73, and for all the years I was haunted by it, which went right up to writing Quiet Time, and then it came back again, and, you know. But I always felt that our marriage was the catalyst for what happened in that family, that it had destabilized that family. There was tremendous parental opposition from his parents to him marrying me. I was a Jewish girl from New York. He was a nice Catholic boy from Kansas. You know, it was the 1970s. There was tremendous opposition on his side of the family. And I always felt guilty. I felt responsible in some way. And so, you know, when Quiet Time came out, the last thing I wanted to do was to have anybody associated with that crime. And when they did, my ex-husband's family was so enraged that the prosecutors got a restraining order to stop them from contacting me or, you know, the elderly witnesses. So it was very, you know, I saw them in the hallway because the pretrial proceedings dragged on and on and on. And I was a witness, you know, to some of the hearings, and we were sequestered. You know, so I got a lot of really angry looks when I was testifying. My former father-in-law, who had pretended to be deaf, stood up and screamed liar at me. The judge had to admonish him. You know, it was very, very ugly. And on the other hand, my former mother-in-law's seven sisters from Kansas embraced me, you know, because they understood that, you know, I was just being honest and that I cared. So, you know, it was very, very painful. I mean, beyond, and frankly, as a writer, I think you'll appreciate this too. When you fictionalize something about real people and you change the way they behave in the service of fictionalizing them, and then you face them, you know, years later in a setting like that, you have to confront yourself and what you've done. You know, I mean, it was fiction, and, you know, I didn't make the family exactly like the family. I changed every identifying characteristic. But deep down, I know that I made my ex-husband a certain way that he wasn't. You know what I mean? So, you know, as a writer, confronting yourself for what you have done, you know, it's a heavy thing. And I you know, I can look myself in the mirror. I think, you know, I'm not saying I don't have any regrets about things, but, you know, I think I did something honest. And because it was honest, it found a target. It found an audience. And it caused something to happen in the real world that was important to happen. I never intended it, but it did. And I think it was because Quiet Time, as heavily fictionalized and, you know, with all the changing of names and everything else, there was something fundamentally true about it. And I think that that's what called out.
I could not have imagined having this conversation today. It is so unique. It is so spellbinding. It is so incredibly personal. And I want to thank you for talking to me about this and telling me this whole story. It's just incredible that you understand that a brutal murder took place. You have questions about it. You have lots of questions about it in terms of why it stopped or why the investigation stopped and why nothing happened for a long period of time. You also had your own involvement in that family from the side of being the person that was not embraced by your husband's immediate family. And you go on to tell this fictionalized account that's very washed, you know, washed of any, you know, protecting the name. Yes, scrubbed to protect the names of the innocent and the not so innocent. And yet, It still acts and serves as a catalyst to bring about for a fictional account brings about a real-life reexamination of the unsolved murder. There's a prosecution. The prosecution is then later dropped, but yet the alleged killer commits suicide on the date of his...
Well, within a week or so.
Well, yeah, within a week or so of the events that started it all off, the murder of your mother-in-law. Oh man, that's an incredible story. That one, I think if you told that one at a dinner table, I don't think there'd be too many forks tinkling on the plate. That's for sure. You'd have people just sitting there with their mouths open saying, wow, you can't make that stuff up. But yet, you did make something up.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you know, it freed me to go back to writing. I mean, once it was over, once it came full circle with his death, it just freed me to go back to writing. And I didn't think I would. I mean, I was so, you know, traumatized is not maybe quite the right word, but so, it was just so painful, and I felt so, you know, and then the second when it came back again, they hated me again, and, you know, it was just, you know, I thought, I don't think I ever want to write again.
Well,
but that coming full circle freed me to write.
Okay. So now you have a series involving the curator of a museum, the art expert, the person.
Yeah, she's a conservator of paintings.
Okay. So tell me that story. Tell me those stories as we move into your series.
Well, as I say, I didn't want to go back to a lawyer, you know, so
right.
I had to invent a new kind of detective, and I like exploring new things. I really like a steep learning curve. So I decided to invent a new kind of heroine. And I like heroines who have sort of unique ways of looking at the world, like certain perceptual eccentricities, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted, you know, a different kind of a heroine. And I wanted to set her in the world of art because I knew very little about it. But I was reading the newspaper one day, and I came across a story about an art historian named Amy Herman, who has written a wonderful book called Visual Intelligence. And she basically teaches cops and FBI agents and lawyers and medical students to hone their observational abilities by looking at paintings in museums. So I thought, wow, that would be a cool skill set for a new kind of a detective. So I started researching, and, you know, I came up with my new heroine, Lily Sparks. So, you know, that's kind of how I got to her. And I think, you know, with a good heroine, same thing with a good villain, they have to have a certain gift or a strength, and then they also have to have a corresponding weakness. And the weakness in a heroine who has keen observational abilities and focuses on details is, you know, the downside to that is that this hyper focus on details can make you miss the bigger picture. It can, in effect, blind you to what's right under your nose. So that gave me her arc, which is across the series, which is moving away from that hyper focus on details and seeing and from seeing the world in black and white to seeing a bigger picture that's in shades of gray. So that's you know, my heroine in a nutshell.
No, Lily Sparks sounds wonderful, absolutely, in the sense that you gave her a very unique gift, but that gift also has with it its drawbacks.
Yeah.
And I know that I am very much drawn to the flawed detectives that also have a sharp sense of this or a sharp sense of that. Sometimes it's psychological, sometimes it's, you know, a curse as well as a gift. But I tend to think of Matt Scudder from Lawrence Block, who had for years that character had been battling his alcohol demons, and that's a central part of his books. Harry Bosch, whose mother was marginalized by society and died, and it's an unsolved murder. So he goes on to a 30 or 40 year career of fighting the good fight for those people that die that nobody cares about. You know, and I look at those kind of authors and I see those detectives. More recently, I'm reading Robert Galbraith, which is the pen name for J.K. Rowling, for her Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott series, a four-book series involving a returning vet, British military guy, loses a leg over in Afghanistan. And does that disability make him, it makes him, of course, different. It makes running down leads, and using the word running down, more like limping down. But you know, and always in pain, you know, from, and always a constant reminder that he's not, you know, he's not what he was. So those kind of characters have always appealed to me. And again, you know, as an investigator for 40 some years in my life, knowing that there are some things that investigators are very good at, but like you said, they have blind spots or they have holes. And sometimes it is in the holes where the cases get solved, not so much in the brilliance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Isn't that, I mean, that's life, really.
That is life, yeah.
You know, it's all, it all happens in the holes and the margins, you know.
Right. So how many books have you written with Lily? I'm sorry.
Lily, I am on October 15th, her second book comes out.
Okay.
It's called Automat. It's involves, because when I decided to do a detective who was in the art world, I decided, wisely or not, that art had to be central to the story in some way. It couldn't just be a gimmick. It couldn't be a hobby. You know, it couldn't be something, you know, that you toss off at the beginning to define the character, and then, you know, they go off and become a detective, you know, do their detective work with nothing to do with art. So her stories are all about the clash between the passion of an artist creating and the passion of a killer destroying. Those are that, you know, all of her stories are that kind of conflict. So Automat has to do, it keys off of the works of Edward Hopper. You may know him from, he's most famous for the painting of the people in the diner at night, the neon-lit diner.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And Automat is his painting of a flapper bent over a coffee cup in a lonely automat at night. And so all of her books key off of some piece of art.
Okay.
And I'm working on the third one now, which actually has to do with crime scene dioramas, which, you know, I think are really fascinating.
Wow.
The whole business of miniaturizing violence, you know, and making it concrete in a crime scene that isn't real is just really fascinating to me. So I've got three books with her.
Okay. That sounds fantastic. And I mentioned Michael Connelly, Harry Bosch, Lawrence Block, Matt Scudder. I should mention Laura Lipman with Tess Monahan. But who do you like to read? And what has you up after midnight at night?
Well, you know, I grew up on Alfred Hitchcock and Twilight Zone.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And science fiction short stories. And I think that those had the biggest influence on me because they were so beautifully set. They were, you know, with interesting characters and surprise twists at the end. And I think that they taught me the value of suspense and structure and ending with a punch. Mm. So now I read basically all varieties of crime novels and psychological suspense, basically anything that gets into why people do what they do.
Okay.
So I like historical true crime books. There's a writer named Paul French who, he's a beautiful writer, but he wrote a book called Midnight in Peking. It's the true story of a 1937 murder of a British diplomat's daughter in Peking at the brink of World War II, just before the Japanese invaded. And
okay.
It's a fascinating story. It's a true story.
Okay.
And but what he did setting the stage was just fantastic. So I like that. You know, contemporary writers, I like Denise Mina, Michael Connelly, Dennis Lehane, Dan Silva.
Okay.
I like noir writers, you know, I like the old Jim Thompson, you know, talk about hard-boiled, and James M. Cain, you know.
Sure.
I like the hard-edged stuff.
Yeah. I bounce back and forth between contemporaries, but then I also have a book of pulps, you know, and you want to talk about the hard-boiled stuff. I like to go bounce back and forth between the two of them, just like, I don't know, to keep me fresh, because if I stay with, you know, one style too much, then I tend to get stale with it, and that way I move around a little bit myself. Well, Steph, how can people reach you, and how can they get in touch with you?
Well, my website is Writer Cain, that's with a cane, I mean a K, writercain.com. That's where Cold Case Story Blog is posted.
Okay.
And I'm also on Facebook at author Stephanie Cain. And people can email me or reach, I guess you can certainly email me through my website, and you could reach me through Facebook.
Well, that was wonderful. And I really do appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. That was really nice. And thank you for that inside information about your first book and all the twists and turns that took. That was spellbinding, to be honest with you. It really was. And I really appreciate the honesty in which you spoke to me about that. So thank you again.
Well, thanks for being such a sensitive and perceptive interviewer.
Well, that's okay. You're a great guest. It makes it easy. Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Matt Speyer. Matt is a 1996 graduate of John Jay College of Criminal Justice with a BS Criminal Justice degree. And since 2005, he is the president of Satellite Investigations, specializing in personal injury investigations and security risk management. Most importantly, we're going to be talking about next week how he developed the Investigators Toolbox, an online resource community for private investigators throughout the United States. He is the owner of PI Perspectives, a weekly podcast heard on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. He's also written a chapter in the book, The Art of Investigation, by CRC Press, and is a regular columnist for PI Magazine.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. If you were either informed, inspired, or entertained by the stories today, don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campaign. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, JohnHoda.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.